Now, I have two recently published books in my hand by the same author. One's fiction, the other a collection of newspaper columns, all trying to make sense of our times. One's called Pussy, a Novel, and the other, The Dog's Last Walk and Other Pieces. Now, I could describe the covers of both books. One's quite arresting, a caricature of someone looking remarkably like a current headline maker in the US, wearing a nappy and clutching a Barbie doll to his young bosom. But instead, I'll welcome the author, Howard Jacobson, well known to our listeners, I think. Howard is a novelist and thinker of note. He won the 2010 Man Booker Prize for The Finkler Question. He was also the brains behind the ABC TV series of 2014, Brilliant Creatures, examining those amazing Australian cultural exports, Germaine Greer, Clive James, Barry Humphreys and Bob Hughes, who all left Australia for Britain in the 60s, just as Howard was heading in the opposite direction. They met at the Equator, he quips. He taught at the University of Sydney for some years, and once back in the UK, wrote a column for 18 years for the independent newspaper till it ceased publication. He's been thinking about the modern predicament, I think you could say, applying his inimitable quinella of qualities of wit and lament. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me on your show.
Now, I know that you were also made an honorary Australian in 2015. Now, before we go any further, what do you have to do to have that bestowed upon you?
Kiss Kylie Minogue.
I see.
It's not the most onerous burden, is it? It was very nice. You go to Australia House and you're lauded and you make a little speech. I said a few words about how one of the things that I most loved about Australia when I first got there was that they call you a bastard, and they called at you in a very, very affectionate way, and you realise that that's a term of endearment. So as soon as I returned to my table, Kylie Minogue, who was sitting opposite, leaned forward and said, "You bastard. You bastard, Jacobson." And that's one of the highlights of my sad old life now.
Yes, and again, we'll get to some of the modern predicament, but what really struck me about that wonderful Brilliant Creatures documentary, the two-parter, was that you said at the time, and of course we wanted to hear this, that you felt the Australian public intelligence was really grossly underrated. And you actually wrote, "They have an ear for cant and commonplace was sharper than ours, their nose for self-righteousness and hypocrisy keener. They weren't just thinkers, these four, they were pugilists of thought." Now, you didn't find that, did you not, in the UK of the time?
No, I didn't. And it's funny, I'd been a student at Cambridge, and the minute I left Cambridge, I got this job. God knows how, I got this job at Sydney University, and people at Cambridge said, "You're going to find them a bit, you know, they're going to be a bit parochial out there. They've got no culture, you know, out there." Nothing was less true, which was why I think, you know, I so enjoyed having this tussle with those four Australians, all saying at that time that they'd left a cultural desert, and I went into what they called a cultural desert and found it the very opposite. I talked more about books in Sydney than I ever had at Cambridge. I listened to more serious music in Sydney than I ever had back in the UK. I had better arguments, I had better times, I had better everything. I mean, I haven't faked this. This wasn't a schmooze, this programme, to inveigle myself into the hearts of Australians. I truly felt that.
You also said that you sought escape from stultifying English conformity in Australia and found it. And when I was visiting recently, a few people said to me, this is in relation to Brexit, which I'd like to get onto now, they said, "Oh dear, we're going to revert to Little England or Little Britain." And, you know, I don't know that Australians really understand what they mean. Do you know what they mean?
Little Britain. Well, Little Britain, yes, I know what they mean. Little Britain is people going around saying we want our sovereignty back. People who've never used the word sovereignty in their life suddenly want it back. Sorry, that's sounding snobbish. But there are some of us over here at the moment who feel thrown back on some kind of elitism we never knew we felt, because we feel our lives are being determined for us by people in Britain who are frightened of something or feel neglected or let down. Well, I understand they feel neglected and let down, but they're kind of paying It's as though every ailment, every distress that any odd English person has felt in the last 20 years is now being laid at the door, has been laid at the door of the European Union. And so this is a kind of, it is a small-minded revenge. It does feel small. One does feel that the country has narrowed. We don't want other people to come in. And you feel that a lot of them don't even want to go out except to have a holiday on the Costa Brava or something. And there I am sounding snobbish again. But that's what it's done. It's divided the country more than anybody outside could possibly understand. It's quite bitter.
Yes,
here, actually.
And in a way, you don't care about sounding snobbish, I don't think. This is what I'm getting from your writing lately, that you've almost decided to come out and say some things that you feel can't be said or haven't been able to be said.
Yes, well, that's because we keep being told all the time that the people have spoken and this is the people's will and we cannot counter the people's will, as though no matter what the people's, whoever the people are, and after all, it was only a little more than half the country that wanted Brexit. So it's hard. We all know, those of us who believe in democracy and who doesn't believe in democracy, also know that there is a problem with democracy and that sometimes the people don't make the right decisions. So it seems to me that we just have to say, in this instance, this is the wrong decision. There's a little phrase out here that's become current, get over it. This has happened, get over it. Whereas we know the history of humanity is of people not getting over it. There are resistance movements. You don't get over things and you shouldn't get over things when you feel those things are wrong. And the minute you try to resist, there is this fury in the country. We've got this new phenomenon out here, the sore winner. It's the strangest thing. The people who've actually got what they want, they themselves seem to be the most unhappy. Could that be because somewhere deep down they know they've done the wrong thing?
Well, let's just explore that a little bit more, because you try to tease this out in a range of ways. The attitude to expertise is something that is really puzzling you, that there seems to be a wariness of those with knowledge, as if it's an epithet, as if they're being punished for not having it. Where did this come from, in your view?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe this kind of thing is always simmering in society. Those who are educated and those who are not. Those who are unwise in their education look down on those who are not educated, and those who are unwise in their uneducatedness resent those who are educated. Maybe that's always there, and this has just been tickled into life. It was tickled into life in Britain during the run-up to Brexit, and of course it's happened in America, partly fed by Brexit, you know. Somewhere or other, Brexit laid the ground, I think, for Donald Trump. But I'll never forget seeing Donald Trump on television in one of his rallies saying, "I love the uneducated." Well, he could have meant, I love everybody, and towards the people who are uneducated, I feel a special compassion, because what a shame that they've lost out on this great gift called education. But he didn't mean that. He meant, I love the uneducated state. And in both countries now, it's as though the people are being turned against. And nobody knows who exactly what it's called, the metropolitan liberal elite, apparently. That's apparently what I am. And we are suddenly the enemy. And what are we the enemy by virtue of? Well, it seems we're the enemy by virtue of just knowing something.
We have interviewed people who say that the elites will use words, that they sport their knowledge in a way that is not always gracious. Now, is that something that you think is a reasonable accusation?
I'm sure it occasionally happens, but when this becomes an argument against education itself, no one is the beneficiary of this. Nobody. There is no point in turning upon education if the effect of that is that there's then going to be education for nobody. All this does is disinherits. When you say to half the American population, I love you for being uneducated, and stay that way, you're not giving them anything, you're taking something from them. And I feel the same about the tone of this debate here. Don't trust experts, it was said. Well, what's an expert? So who do you trust instead? Trust your own mind. Well, where does a mind make its decisions from? You're not just born with the capacity to know whether we should belong to the European Union or not. You have to read, you have to think, you have to make judgments. Judgment, it's as though judgment itself is now under question. We're all allowed an opinion, but to actually form a judgment, to refine a judgment.
Well, in fact, Howard Jacobsman, you recently wrote for The Guardian on Donald Trump and how a man of few words, this is something that's really preoccupying. He reaches the pinnacle of power. Now, what is it about, or his use of the language, that you think is such a guide to him?
Yes. Well, this, I want to make clear that the one thing I'm not saying is I wish Donald Trump were an orator. What interests me about his language is how he's got no way out of himself because he hasn't got the words to help himself out of himself. Words are not just rhetorical flourishes. Words are the means by which we escape what's mean and narrow and constricted and repetitive in ourselves. If you don't have the words to help you out, you won't get out. What he's done, it seems to me, is with this constricted, narrow vocabulary, encouraged people to feel small in themselves. You think how limiting his message was to the American people. You know, build the wall, they chanted. Lock her up. Everything was confined. And it's fascinating to me to just see, forget about Trump himself, just as a lesson about what language is. If you don't have the words, you don't even have the knowledge that you need a new thought. Trump never reaches for another thought because he doesn't have the words to reach for another thought with.
Look, in one of your columns, Conformity Kills, you write about the problem with sort of grand narratives or narratives what you've come to realise is that they just don't seem to work, and that what seems to work are simpler tales of goodies and baddies, and accordingly, your very funny novel, Pussy, it's almost like you're reverting to parables, which is a rather famous Jew of many years ago also relied upon. Is that what you think we need to revert to?
I wrote my Trump book, whatever you call it, should really be called a fable, I suppose.
Yes.
In just a few weeks, so it's a reviewer has just called it a kind of like a hand grenade. I tossed a hand grenade into the whole thing because it seemed to me. Actually, to say it seemed to me something needed saying makes it grander than it is. I had to say it.
You had to
say it. I just couldn't live with it. Why it felt so personal to me, I don't know. I think it's because I'm a writer and I believe in words. I believe in words more than I believe in anything, really. Maybe I believe to a preposterous degree in words. But words to me are our liberation. And whenever there is a kind of implicit war on words, whenever people are being told, use fewer, be more stupid, be more narrow, I think we live it. Those are terrible times.
Well, it's certainly very, very amusing. This is a sadness descended on Fracassus, who is the particular person modelled on somebody. He realised he had no friends to say goodbye to as he realises that mortality is closing in. What have I achieved here, he thought aloud. I haven't built a casino. I haven't wrestled. I haven't had much in the way of pussy. In fact, he hadn't had any pussy, but didn't want to admit that to himself. The people love me, but I don't love them.
Did I write that? No,
you did write that.
It's better than I thought.
Is this... Britain has always loved words. So do you detect a certain sort of bonsai quality developing in Britain's relationship with words leading up to this election?
I think there is... I've become very tedious here, so stop me. I think something is going on, and it's to do with the world of online communication. It's no coincidence that Trump is so happy on Twitter. Twitter was waiting for Trump. It was there. There was the medium waiting for the man. Cometh the medium, cometh the man. And he just fitted into Twitter as though it was perfect for him. Fracassus, in my novel, his mother is a little worried when his father puts him on Twitter that he actually won't have enough words to do a tweet with. So she's relieved to discover you don't actually have to use all 140 characters. But behind Twitter, there are all these platforms in which people... I talk about it a lot in my book of essays. People now state, it's a world of asseveration. It's just opinion. This, I think this, I think that. And there's a thumb up and a thumb down, as though, you know, those are the only, do you like, do you not like? And we know everything that matters to us lives between the thumb up and the thumb down. There's that whole range of complex, nuance, feeling and opinion that can't be represented by a thumb up or a thumb down. But increasingly, it struck me as I was coming to the end of my columns, those sorts of comments that people stick on your columns online to tell you what they think of you were becoming just nastier and nastier and nastier, mm-hmm. as though people couldn't... They didn't know when I was playing. They didn't know when I was being ironical. They just thought everything was what I think. Actually, I don't always know. I very rarely know what I think. One of the things that made me enjoy writing my columns, one of the things about being a novelist for me anyway, has always been you find your way to thought through language. You don't start off knowing. If you start off knowing what you think, you're not going to write a good book. You're not even going to write a good column. The great things happen when you discover, my God, do I think that? And what takes you to that is language, which is not you. Language is a common tool. It's what links you to humanity and gets you out of yourself.
On that marvellously eloquent note, we will close. And thank you very much indeed. I must say I did enjoy reading all of these various comments.
I'm pleased to hear that. Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
Howard Jacobson and his assembled his columns from The Independent in The Dog's Last Walk and other pieces. It's published by Bloomsbury. And Pussy, the novel, which is very funny, is published by Penguin Random House. Your thoughts? Most welcome. I know a lot of you read Howard Jacobson and argue with him, but that's what he wants.